Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of the AfriCast. My name is Brendan Lotz, and joining me today is Clinton Matos.
Hello, everybody.
And Robin Lee Chetty.
Hey, how's it going?
Fantastic. Last podcast of the year. Two more working days left. I am absolutely done with 2020. Don't let it smack you where the good Lord split you. Goodbye, we're done with you.
I'm seeing people already on leave. I've been emailing them. I get the automatic reply. I'm so jealous.
Yeah, the entire public relations industry has just shut down in South Africa, at least from what I've seen.
It's hilarious. Yesterday, I got an email from someone asking for a document to be sent to them again because the one I sent just was wrong. So I sent them the revised version, and then I got the automatic reply saying I'm on holiday. It's like, come on. It took me like 5 minutes to write that email. Did you go on holiday the last 5 minutes?
Anyway. Yeah. Oh, well, it's been a challenging year, and what better way to remember that than by going through it painfully and very slowly. So that's what we're going to do this year. That's the podcast. So if you don't want to be depressed, skip ahead. We're going to talk about games a little bit later, but right now I think it's a good time to reflect on the year that was, maybe learn something, maybe regret a few things. Who knows what we're going to come out of feeling like at the end of this, but we're going to do it anyway. I think the first place I want to start is perhaps the only tech expo that took place this year, which was CES 2020 in Las Vegas. That seems to have been the only one that managed to make it through without a cancellation. It was a CES, just like every other CES that we've had before. Couple of interesting announcements, I think, but all of that was kind of drowned in the news of COVID-19 spreading around the world. At that stage, I think it was still very much in China, and everybody was looking at the daily figures that were coming out and worrying about it spreading to other parts of the world. And here we are 12 months later, and every country in the world seems to have been touched by COVID-19.
I remember in those early days, a lot of people, you know, putting aside the idiots that thought it wasn't real, a lot of people were kind of saying, yeah, that sucks, but it's not here yet. Mm-hmm. Or they were saying, oh, it will never get here. And then, as we'll discuss, it slowly got there, there being the whole world. And it was, in retrospect, it was a real slow burn, and then it was a big burn.
Yeah, so
it probably came to a head during MWC, right?
Like, yeah.
It kind of sunk in for a lot of people.
That actually segues very nicely, Robin, is that at around the time that MWC Mobile World Congress was supposed to be happening, They actually pushed it quite far. MWC was happening for the longest time, and then I think it was a week before the event was meant to start.
Yeah, I think so. What happened was, like, quite a few of the exhibitors, I think, like LG, for example, was one of the first to say we're actually canceling all our in-person events for for MWC, and then slowly but surely during that week, all other manufacturers or exhibitors were saying the same, and then I think GSMA just kind of pulled the plug and took our decision and said, yeah, sorry, guys, not going to happen this year.
Yeah, and it went online, and that sort of kicked off what I am calling a cataclysmic series of events where everybody decided that they were going to host an online live stream event. We'll get to that in a second, though, because as Mobile World Congress was cancelled, South Africa went into lockdown towards the tail end of March, and that's mainly where our conversation starts. So you guys, do you remember the early days of lockdown well? The 90 days to prepare our hospitals and healthcare services for COVID-19?
Yeah,
I mean, go ahead, Glenn.
I remember everybody in the house was kind of around the TV. You know, we don't usually get together as a family and watch TV at the same time anymore, but we were all at the TV and they announced it. And we were just, you know, very worried, as everyone was. My mom was like, tomorrow I need to go buy canned food and frozen food. And I tried to tell her to not go the next day because you should just go the day after, because everyone will have the same idea.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was a very worrying time, but I think the worry was justified.
Yeah.
I don't want to get like overblown here, but I kind of understood the like the nuclear scare that people had years ago, where you're just kind of sitting around the TV and thinking, well, we might die at any point. Not to be overblown, but it really did feel like a defining moment in the history of the whole world and South Africa. You, Robin, sorry, I cut you off there.
No, I was just going to say that it was pretty much the same as it always has been for me. I think in the week leading up to the president's address, our offices were based in WeWork, and we were advised to essentially everyone that can work from home should work from home. And then a few days later, it was the president's address happened.
Yeah.
And yeah, I kind of kickstarted that process. But for me, I remember it was the 26th of March, purely for the fact that I was checking into a Huawei online media briefing for a phone. Had an interview that day, and Huawei delivered a phone for review as well. So it was like very much a normal day for me.
Yeah.
So it didn't really kind of sink in. I think once I started having to go out to do shopping and those kind of things, I just saw how stark everything was and really how bleak the whole kind of situation was. That's when it really sunk in for me.
Yeah. I mean, I was actually at a wedding a month before the lockdown began. And at that wedding, COVID was a conversation. And rather stupidly, myself and a couple of people weren't too worried about it because, like Clinton said, it wasn't here. You know, it's far away. It's in China. It's never going to reach here. As we quickly learned, though, the world is much smaller than any of us anticipated. And it wasn't long before there were infections in South Africa and we locked down. I remember the day that President Ramaphosa came up and had his first, as they have now become known, family meetings, and all the hope and kind of hopelessness at the same time that we felt. I remember seeing Ramaphosa speak and going, hey, I mean, this looks really good. Like, government seems to know what it's doing. It has a plan in place. And I just want to remind everybody, at the time where this was happening, we knew very little about COVID-19. Like, I think we still these days know very little about this disease.
I mean, at the time when Ramaphosa gave his address, if I'm not mistaken, I might be mixing up the timeline here, but at the time then, the World Health Organization was still saying that masks are only required for people who have symptoms, and they were actually advising against not wearing them if you hadn't been infected yet.
Yeah.
And now we know, my God, everyone needs to be wearing a mask at all times. Please, 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 please. So, and I don't mean to make light of that, but that was the situation at that time.
Yeah.
We were just none the wiser. And we're like, oh, well, I don't need a mask yet, especially because a lot of people had already bought out all the masks and were hoarding them and stuff like that. And we just didn't know yet.
Yeah, people like this game.
Yeah.
I still remember shortly after the lockdown happened, I can't remember how much after, it might have been a few days, it might have been a week or two, but I needed to go to the pharmacy for important medication. I wasn't there just for fun. I don't know who goes to a pharmacy. But I heard the pharmacist having a very loud argument with someone because they were trying to sell a one-use mask for R100.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
I don't remember which pharmacy it was, and I maybe shouldn't say because they might get angry at me, but R100 for a single-use mask. And the woman kept repeating, yes, sir, a single-use mask, R99. Sir, that's not just the price. I don't set the price. I don't like people shouting at those who work in retail and stuff like that. But that's very justifiable anger. That's ridiculous.
Yeah. And as Ramaphosa's address was completed, we then started to become acquainted with the National Disaster Management Act, which I have several thoughts about. I won't share them here. But that became the piece of legislation that has, there's no easy way to say this, ruled our lives for the last, what is it now, 6-9 months? March, April, May, June, July, August, September. Yeah, 9 months. For 9 months, this piece of legislation has dictated to us what we can and can't do. And there's been varying levels about what we can and can't do. But I want to focus on the early days, because with all of us stuck at home, and I mean, rightfully so, to try and curb the spread of the COVID-19 disease, it became weird that e-commerce wasn't a focus for government. We saw e-tailers such as Takealot having to basically go offline for a couple of weeks in order to change what they were allowed to sell, because under the National Disaster Management Act, the presidency and a whole bunch of other advisors basically said that you could only trade in essential goods, only essential workers could work. And essential was a very narrow definition. That was things like medication, food, some clothing. But it quickly became clear that the e-commerce restrictions were just a little bit weird and maybe a bit archaic. I know, to my mind, there were a couple of problems. For one, technology not being labeled as an essential product during a time where we had also just asked everybody to work from home seemed odd. This was also at a time where Eskom started load shedding. So if something fried when Eskom decided to turn the power back on, sucks for you. And there were just some really weird things. I remember the hot food controversy had people's backs raised because you couldn't go to Woolies and get a hot chicken anymore, though. That was the line that a lot of people used, even though I kind of felt like there was a better argument to be made, such as if somebody is an essential worker and they need to stop and get lunch, where do they go?
So
after, I think it was about 2 months, e-commerce sort of slowly started opening up again as the restrictions. So I think it was towards the end of April where we started to see the level system introduced. Or was it towards May? Everything just blurs into one.
Yeah, and especially it doesn't help that government did kind of lay this stuff out on its website and stuff, but it's always been so loosey-goosey in terms of enforcement. But yeah, as you said, they said there's going to be the lockdown's still going to be hard, but it's going to be softer.
Yeah.
They're basically going to lift some restrictions, but others it will still play, and there's going to be a curfew, but you're allowed out at certain times in the night. The South African website about lockdown, which we'll link to, has all those rules according to the levels, but it was hard to keep track of.
It was very hard to keep track, especially because initially what happened was the level system was introduced to us with a 5-tier system where lockdown level 5 was the strictest, where there was basically no economic activity going on in the country. And then level 4 would ease restrictions and so on and so forth as you move down the levels. So I think it was around May where we started to see more the easing of restrictions happening. One of the things that was a massive point of contention was the inability to sell or purchase alcohol and tobacco. The tobacco one, I know, was met with numerous court challenges, one of which won out in the Western Cape High Court just last week, stating that the banning of tobacco sales was unconstitutional. But during that time, if you were smoking cigarettes, you were likely smoking illegal cigarettes.
Yeah. So, Brendan, before we get to that whole debacle, because even though I don't smoke, I also have a lot to say about that. I just want to, for people who are maybe out of the country or people who have forgotten, the rationale that the government provided for banning those two, what do they call them? Sin products, I think.
Sin tax.
The rationale government gave was this. When people drink, they get rowdy, they hurt themselves and the people around them. And if that happened, they would take up a very important bed in a hospital that could have been used for someone who has COVID. So that was I don't want to say excuse, that was the rationale behind the alcohol ban. The cigarette ban was, oh my God, they were saying that people, if they were allowed to smoke, would be sharing smokes with each other and they would transmit COVID to each other like that. Listen.
When people's all.
Yeah, when people's listen, all.
I hate cigarettes. I think they are a very predatory product. They are you know, habit-inducing. The whole industry, I think, is corrupt and terrible. But it's dumb that they banned cigarettes. They should have let people smoke. And I think Brendan's going to talk about that now. And the fact that the whole ban was a farce anyway.
So I smoke, and I have friends that smoke as well. And midway through the 3 months that we were supposed to be in lockdown, we both ran out of cigarettes. And this friend of mine turned to getting cigarettes through a ne'er-do-well source. And I say ne'er-do-well because these cigarettes are not things that you would find in on shelves. A brand that I remember is Sharp. I've never heard of it. Haven't seen it in stores since lockdown lifted.
Don't they make TVs?
No, a different brand. Unrelated completely. But what you started seeing was this black market, or illicit market rather, for cigarettes and alcohol, where people were charging, and I'm not joking here, R100,000 for a box of 20 cigarettes. Now, a lot of people are going to look at me and go, oh, but a box of cigarettes costs R50,000. Now it does. Ahead of lockdown, between $30 and $40 would get you a box of 20 cigarettes. So when lockdown hit, it was like R100,000, maybe even more. If you were looking for a known brand of cigarettes, something like your Dunhill or your Peter Stuyvesant, my goodness, it was A, near impossible to find, and B, they were charging you $160 for a packet of those cigarettes. So people tell me. And yeah, that's what I saw online through Twitter and various other social media platforms.
That's how it is. High demand, low stock. Prices go through the roof.
And what is bizarre to me is why government – look, I get the alcohol ban. That makes sense. People get drunk. They get behind the wheel of a car. Then they have to go into ICU.
Yeah, and I also want to say that's not just us talking. I have two friends who are doctors.
Yeah.
Both of them were very on board with the alcohol ban. Even before lockdown and corona, they said that the amount of people who come in to the emergency room, to the general surgery with things that are directly caused to alcohol and people getting into fights and stuff like that is so high. Yeah. So doctors, most doctors that at least I know personally have said they were very on board. And it's not just those two I spoke to. It was the entire staff of doctors. I won't name them, but the whole staff was very happy about that ban.
Yeah. And it makes
doctors who drank themselves.
And I mean, this is not to say that like alcohol is evil. And like if you drink, that's your prerogative. I mean, that's up to you. I'm not especially a fan of alcohol, but I mean, it's your life. Do what you want with it. It's your body. As long as you're not affecting other people. But the problem is that when people get drunk, they do at times end up affecting people or other people around them, often innocent bystanders. So I get that. The rationale for smoking was that if people spread this, they'll share cigarettes. What do you think an illicit market charging people $160 for cigarettes meant? Like a friend of mine who had access to cigarettes was sharing them with other people. Bouncing a cigarette, as the colloquial term is, between people. And
because they were so expensive.
Exactly. Because they were so expensive, because you couldn't get them through a legal channel. I mean, it boggles the mind that this was added to that is the amount of tax that government lost out on. Now, this is the thing that gets me, is that government allowed networks of criminals to sell cigarettes by banning the sale of cigarettes through legal channels. People did not stop smoking, right? There were various studies. I think there was something like 90% of smokers who smoked before lockdown continued smoking in lockdown. That was a study done by the University of Cape Town. Don't really want to put too much sway in it because it's just one institution with a small sample group. But it does kind of help to inform the conversation. So, yeah, very, very silly things that were banned by government. Things like not being able to buy a T-shirt. Like you could only buy winter clothes because we were in the winter season. I get that, but really? Is that how far the restriction you want to go to?
You couldn't even buy underwear at some point.
Yeah. I mean, it was like, just bizarre.
Underwear. We need that. That's something we need, guys. And another thing I want to add to Brendan's observations here, one that's more substantiated and another one that's more tinfoil hat. A lot of people saying that the alcohol and tobacco bans were done because the various ministers in charge have interests in the legal side of those things. I won't talk to that. That is hearsay. That is street talk. I'm almost certain that in a few years, a big scandal will come out that that's the case. But for now, I'm covering my butt and saying it's all hearsay and street talk. Anyway, the other thing that's more substantial is everything that Brendan's talked about for cigarettes also applies to alcohol.
Yeah.
People didn't stop drinking. They just got the drinks illegally. I have no idea if they were getting off-brand moonshine or they were getting actual alcohol, actual brand name stuff. But people were still drinking. But again, it was just illegal and with no government oversight.
The one thing I do just want to mention as an aside to this is that when alcohol was banned, people started brewing their own booze, which I thought was kind of great.
Oh, my God. There's that fantastic picture that went around of one of the supermarkets that had pineapples right next to sugar, right next to bags of instant yeast.
Yeah.
For anyone who doesn't know, those are the three ingredients to make alcohol at home.
Yeah.
And that's not me spreading illicit knowledge. It's very basic primary school science.
Yeah. So that was really great. In addition to that, people started to bake sour bread dough. Everybody kind of developed a new skill in the kitchen, which I thought was really awesome to see.
That was really awesome.
That was really, really cool. And folks sharing photos of their sourdough bread. Like, I love sourdough bread and I love making it, the whole process. It was really, really fantastic to see. And I just want to kind of take an aside to this is that as disconnected as we were, I don't think I felt more a part of South Africa than I did during lockdown. Because for one, it just felt like everybody was going through the same BS that I was going through. And it kind of made me feel like, okay, it's terrible. I miss being able to see my parents. I miss being able to like go out and socialize with friends. But it's kind of cool that all of us are in this boat together. Like, we're all having to be back before curfew and all that sort of stuff. Yeah, there was a nice bit of unity I felt as a South African with us all going through this nonsense. From there, though, let's go back to how the world was dealing with this. At around this time, which is around June, July, E3 was meant to be happening. Obviously, that was cancelled because I think we were still in the midst of outbreaks around the world. And as with everything in 2020, these things shifted online. So I want to ask you guys, do you remember anything from E3 2020?
No, I can save the time of other questions we'll probably get to for. I don't remember the majority of events and announcements. I think it was only, and we'll get to it, but now there was some things announced for like Marvel and some game awards things. I've only really taken attention to that because I think people are starting to think past the pandemic because the vaccines are on the rise and everything. But while we were all dealing with more important things than games, aka our lives, we were all ignoring these events, but people still did them. And again, I don't want to take the wind out of your sails, but there was also like South African Comic Con, Rage.
Yeah.
And a few other big international things. Oh, and even international Comic-Con, the big, you know, San Diego Comic-Con was online, and it came and went, and no one batted an eye at all.
And I think that kind of raises a point. Oh, Robin, hang on, sorry, I didn't get to you. Do you remember anything from E3 2020?
Nope, nothing comes to mind.
Yeah, and I think this is kind of, it speaks to the wider issue with these sorts of events, is that they happen online, and doesn't seem like anybody cares, you know? I mean, like, sure, you get your folks like Apple and Huawei hosting a live stream for product releases, and that's all good and well, but when it comes to something like a big event like E3, I just don't think people cared. And I think at the point that these events happened, people were already fatigued or were already experiencing Zoom fatigue, which we'll get to in a bit. But I think that some of these things were just became so forgettable.
Yeah, so I think, like as you mentioned, those events are kind of inconsequential because of the fact that traditionally they are in person. Rage is kind of Rage because of the fact that everyone's inside the dome experiencing all these games and kind of all the other elements that are around Rage. the same thing for Comic-Con Africa. It was a fairly large event last year at Gallagher Estate. But now to shift it completely online, the real appeal of the event falls away, in my view. The reason why your Apples, Samsungs, Huawei's can do their online events is because traditionally they have held live streams and they have experience in those elements. For those kind of other events, it just doesn't make sense. It seems more the fact that they wanted to have something happen rather than they wanted to deliver a great experience. I think the only good digital experience as far as like a, I guess, more entertainment, gaming slash movie kind of feel was probably DC's fandom. But nothing else really comes to mind on that front. So I think, yeah, there's some serious learning curves as far as some of the companies are concerned.
And it's not even just that the companies did a quote-unquote like bad job. It's that, again, like you said, you go to Rage because they usually had games that you couldn't play because they weren't out yet. And in South Africa, that is a real rarity. Mm. And even aside from that, like I've been wanting to buy a mouse for a long time. And because it's such an ergonomic thing, what you usually want to do is try it in your hands before you buy. And Rage was one of the best places to do that. The stands of the manufacturers had the mice, the mouses, whatever the plural is, they had them out and you could go and try. And I was looking forward to doing that, but you just can't do that online.
Yeah, and I mean, you can't even do that right now anymore. No. You can't walk into a shop and start touching things because people will give you very dirty looks.
That is really also, even if there's a vaccine, I mean, there is a vaccine. Even if there's a widespread vaccine in the next few months that you can get at like the local pharmacy without an appointment and for very cheap, even if that happens, I have to think that the physical buying experience has been permanently damaged because people are always going to be wary about going into the public now. You know, that's putting aside a lot of idiots who don't believe that it's a thing and have been going without a mask. I'm just going to ignore them for most of our conversations.
Yeah,
because they should be ignored. But I think the physical buying experience has already been damaged because of online shopping for the past few years, and now they've been dealt this blow. I don't know what it's going to look like in the next few years, but that's a whole nother kettle of fish.
I do wonder though whether there'd be a potentially like an increase in the number of returns as a result. I know like a lot of people will be shopping online far more, but just kind of seeing the ratios or the percentages, just in terms of. They're going to be far more returns because people don't have that tangible in-person experience for retail anymore. Because I've been to a few events where they kind of look at the finer points as far as the retail experience, how South Africans actually enjoy researching a device first online and then going in-store and then completing the purchase. That's not going to happen anymore.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it's definitely changed things, but I just want to circle back to your point, Robin, about lessons being learned with the live streaming thing. I think that's a very, very important lesson for many companies to heed going into 2021. Is that just because you can host a live stream doesn't mean you should. I can count on one hand, in fact, two fingers, the amount of live streams that I tuned into that were engaging and well executed. So many people simply just pointed a camera at their face, opened up Zoom, and was like, we're hosting an event this way.
Yeah, and I think – sorry, Brent.
Yeah?
I think something that – I mean, we can speak from a media point of view. We get like 100 press releases every day, and every press release is saying, hey, my client has something really cool that your readers should spend money on. Here's a press release. And on behalf of what we do, we have to sort through those and find the ones which actually are good for you guys to read and think about and maybe use your money on. But I kind of got hoodwinked a few times this year because they said we're going to have the best live stream ever and we're going to present what this is and why it sounds good. And in the press release, in the email, made it sound that way. And then, like you said, we got into the live stream and it was just, this is the new thing. This is what it's going to cost. It's a nothing burger. I kind of got hoodwinked a few times. That's my own fault. But for the general populace, that's even worse because there was so little in terms of what you should be using your time on and what's worth it.
Yeah, and I think that is kind of highlighted in the fact about just how many live streams we attended. For instance, I mean, there was one about a local firm doing something.
that they were passing off as some really new and exciting thing that they had been doing, but it was actually something that they had announced a month prior, and it wasn't all that exciting. This was just the live stream was literally just a way to drum up interest about it. And it begs the question, why even do this? Why? Like, I can understand that you want to remain relevant, but surely something like this, a poorly executed live stream, is worse than just not doing one. Just send a press release. And I've seen so many people online just complain about Zoom meetings that could have been an email. And these things take time, and people really don't want to sit in front of a camera having to listen to this, that, and the next thing. Somebody talking about something. Especially during this time. I do want to move on very rapidly, though. We had IFA come and go as well with very little fanfare. Huawei announced a few products. I think the most notable thing from IFA 2020 was that Huawei didn't announce a smartphone, which, I mean, that goes to show you how engaging that event was. And they did eventually announce a phone later that year. But we now started moving into U.S. election territory, and things became very, what's a very diplomatic way of describing this? Concerning. Terrible. Concerning. No, those are not diplomatic, guys. Concerning is diplomatic. It all started off in, I think it was June? Yeah, June. Twitter labeled a tweet from Donald Trump as manipulated media for the first time ever. And that set off a chain of events that I think we all saw coming. Donald Trump got angry at social media. A bit of context around this. In recent years, there's been an increasing amount of noise surrounding a conspiracy theory to deplatform. You can't see what I'm doing, but I'm using air quotes for some of these words. In air quotes, deplatform people for being too right-wing. Now, I struggle to see how this is the case. For one, I don't believe that deplatforming is a thing or cancel culture is a thing. If you say something stupid and people call you out for it, that's on you. It's not culture. It's just you did something stupid and you're now paying the consequences of that. So Donald Trump started tweeting a whole bunch of stuff, and as we got closer to the elections, Twitter started to be very aggressive in how it was labeling his tweets. Things like misinformation, this tweet is problematic, this media has been disabled due to a response to a report by the copyright owner. I mean, it basically seemed like Trump was pushing social media to see how far it would go. And eventually they just started labeling his tweets, hiding his tweets, making sure that his tweets didn't reach as wide audience. And that ultimately led to Trump saying, well, we need to amend the legislation. We need to change the rules so that social media companies don't enjoy the protections that they enjoy at the moment. And that's been a conversation that's been going on for ages now. I just want to gauge what you guys think about this. Has social media helped at all in 2020 as regards like extreme right-wing views, extreme left-wing, extremist views, I think is the better term. Has it done anything, do you think? Or is it simply just amplified noise?
Yeah, I think it's been as bad.
I think amplified.
Do you think it's been amplified just because we're paying more attention to it? Or do you think, my opinion of this is that it's kind of the same as it's been every year. It's been this bad for a long time. We're stuck in our homes bored, and now we're paying more attention to it. And also because it's an election year, it came into sharp focus. I mean, there's countless stories out there about how social media and external countries, Russia, interfered in the 2016 elections, and I think this year was just more of the same. The Americans learned just about nothing, I think, when it came to the elections. So not to kind of discredit everything we're talking about here and say nothing changed, but I think it's just more of the same. this is just a complete repeat of 2016, but thank God it looks like Trump's not going to win again. That's my view. Robin, I cut you off there. What were you going to say?
Well, I was going to say it's amplified for me purely for the fact that all these social media platforms are driven by algorithms. Mm-hmm. And the algorithms are designed to keep you on the platform for as long as possible. So, for example, something like Twitter, you're going to see one, either views that complement your own, mm-hmm. or two, views that are the complete opposite of your own and that you want to engage with as a result.
That
so,
is the term you're looking for.
Yeah, so I take, for example, something like YouTube, and I think we've discussed this as well, Brendan, where you'll sometimes see a video from a kind of far-right or ultra-conservative outlet or channel, mm. and then because you've watched the video, just to kind of see what they're talking about, YouTube will serve you up more of that kind of content in the recommendations. And that's not because you necessarily like that content. It's because you simply watch the video because you wanted to gauge or get an idea of what they're talking about.
And I can actually attest to that, Robin, because there are a couple of local grifters here in South Africa. I'm going to use the word grifter because that's all they are.
I used that exact term to describe a company I was having problems with yesterday, so that's why I was laughing.
Yeah, so I've seen a couple of their posts on social media, and out of morbid curiosity, I would go and see what these people had to say, have a good laugh at the hilarity of what they are suggesting. And true as what you've just described, Robin, I've noticed that I've been served a whole bunch more right-wing content. Folks like Steven Crowder keep popping up into my recommendations, and I don't like that content. I don't want to watch it, but YouTube keeps recommending it to me because of a few lapses in judgment where I've been like, what's this idiot talking about? And hit play. But yeah, it's very concerning to me from my perspective, how much social media has become a part of the daily discourse in our lives. And my concern is more towards how these platforms deal with misinformation. So in the US, we see this big push to stamp out election misinformation, all that sort of stuff. But when it comes to actually reporting these sorts of things or taking action against posts like this, folks here in South Africa have very little ways of dealing with things. And I hate to bring this up for the umpteenth time, but if you look at a place like, or if you look at something like Facebook in Myanmar, when that incident happened, Facebook has now had to set up an office in Myanmar so that it understands what's happening locally. And I feel like that's something that all social media platforms lack at the moment, is local context and understanding of issues around the world.
Brendan, we have a Facebook office here in South Africa. They've got official foot on the ground. I still see a lot of misinformation about the country on local Facebook.
I mean, you say that though, Clinton, but I mean, have you ever spoken to a Facebook representative from South Africa direct face-to-face?
I mean, I haven't, but our old editor did, and one of our old journalists did. I don't know.
So I did as well.
Yes.
If I could just kind of interject here.
Yeah.
So it was during a Facebook briefing around their work with Africa Check and kind of bringing on third-party moderators to kind of fact-check content on their platform. And Facebook took a very hard line and said that they are not bastions of truth. And I took great umbrage with that statement. And I kind of pushed them back on that, and I kind of asked them why that is the case, especially as news. And we're not just talking about what your racist uncle says around the dinner table. Actual news platforms share content on Facebook. Facebook has its own news feed.
Yeah.
So to my mind, it needs to be a bastion as far as the truth goes, if it wants to be considered a news platform, which it currently is.
Yeah, and this is the thing that I feel that a lot of these companies simply pass the buck. And in a sense, I tend to agree with Trump in a way. Let me just finish my thought. In that these companies do have safe harbor protections because they are classified as
they're not classified as publishers, rather. So they don't have to take responsibility for what happens on their platform. Only when there's things like copyright or like a human rights violation do they have to step in, because there are laws around that sort of thing. But if you post that, I don't know, all cows are actually purple, if Facebook doesn't feel that that's something that needs to be addressed, they're not going to, even though it probably is something that should be addressed. And this circles back to my point around local understanding. Like, it's good to see that Facebook is working with AfricaCheck, but does Facebook have a understanding of South African culture? Does it understand things like traditional healers? Does it understand things like that in a location or a place like Soweto, there isn't really space to social distance? Like, do they understand things like that? Because more and more I get the impression that they don't. We saw this earlier this year as well with Uber, where there were several reports of harassment by Uber and Uber Eats drivers. And it took Uber a very long time to kind of address this. They have since addressed that, which is really good to see. But it just feels to me that these companies operate in places around the world, but fail to put investments into making sure that their platforms are, I hate to use this, but safe for everybody to use.
It seems that they want all the benefit, which is profit, market share, lots of users, without any of the responsibility of making sure, again, that those people who are making their money are safe. All the profit, none of the worry, is what it seems like.
And during
to answer your question there, yeah. Brendan, and I see what you did there with the cars and the purple analogy. A more recent example of how Facebook's been handling issues outside of the US, in India, actually this month already, they have failed to address problematic statements and threats that have been leveled by Hindu extremists in the region.
Yeah.
Purely out of fear for what it could mean for the officers in the region and potentially threats to the staff members. And I understand the need to keep your employees safe. But at the same time, you are now complicit, running the risk of doing the same thing as doing what happened in Myanmar, where you kind of turn a blind eye and not really wanting to, I guess, rattle the cage.
So, I mean, I think there has been some, at least in the US, we saw faces like Twitter and Facebook doing a really good job of stemming misinformation during the elections.
Yeah. But lots of times, so sorry, Brendan, to say that, it was hilarious. The day after the election, it was clear that Trump was losing the election and was on the path to losing, and he kept tweeting how he wasn't losing, and every single one of his tweets, there were like 30 tweets in a row which Twitter had to put a mark on, that they either hid the tweet completely or put it behind a message saying this is untrue.
There was, it has like been disputed in a row.
My God, sorry, I keep interrupting you. Go ahead.
So there was some great work done in terms of stemming the tide of misinformation in the US. However, since then, there's now another problem in that, the election was hacked and it was compromised and it was rigged. And that's a whole nother kettle of fish. I do want to just focus on pre-election. So Facebook and Twitter did a really good job. Well done. I'm going to give you a round of applause. For the elections in the US, what about elections in other parts of the world? It's kind of offensive to me that the US, or these companies that are based in the US, think that it's only the US that has to deal with problems with elections. This is something that happens around the world, all right? It's not only in the United States of Trump. It happens all around the world. And I do hope to see in the next couple of years these sorts of efforts that have been put in place reach other parts of the world. Because like I said, is that you can't be, or I've said in the past rather, I don't think I've said it today, is that you can't be a global company and not act locally. You have to. You have to act at a local level. You can't just take a business model and drop it in a place and think that it'll work. Case in point is Uber. You take Uber from San Francisco, you drop it in South Africa as it was. It wasn't really successful. When they started adding things like being able to pay for cash, safety features, a whole bunch of things,
started to take off a lot more. So there's got to be a local context to these decisions. And I don't see that happening in social media, at least not as relates to 2020.
I think there's also the worry that because Facebook is a company that was born and bred in America, they kind of have a quote-unquote right to have a say in the elections.
Mm-hmm.
But I think if they maybe, if like, for example, if a local politician says all cows are purple and Facebook comes and marks it as not true or contested, I think a large amount of local people might say, how dare an American company put their nose in when what they're really just trying to do is keep things as a playing field. So I think that's also another thing you have to consider, is that people outside of America may not share that view that an American company can put those warnings on messages from local people.
Absolutely. But I think that this is also endemic of the problem that Facebook has, where it's a global company that doesn't really focus too much on a local frame of mind. And maybe if it was a little bit more involved in how in the nations where it was present, like, maybe people would be a lot more open to saying, okay, well, Facebook says that this is problematic. Maybe I can trust that. As it stands right now, though, every time Facebook says something, I kind of just go, okay, cool. I mean, what's Zuckerberg trying to sell me now? I've just stopped going onto Facebook because it's just a complete mess of tripe.
Well, I think after Cambridge Analytica, Facebook has lost a lot of trust.
Absolutely.
It's going to take quite a long time before they can earn their trust back.
I honestly disagree. I think, I don't have the numbers, obviously, but most of the people who are going on Facebook and spewing tripe are still doing it despite the Cambridge Analytica. I think it's easy for us who work in tech and have an interest, like a vested personal interest in tech outside of our jobs. We care about this stuff and we keep up with it. I think 99% of people and Facebook users just don't care. And Facebook does so much bad stuff with your information. And a lot of people either don't know that's happening, or when they find out, they don't care because they don't understand, or they don't want to learn about the implications of that. So again, I don't want to be a downer, but I think most people just don't care. And they still, your racist uncle is still going on Facebook, and he's still part of group chats and groups on Facebook that are bad, that are perpetuating these problems. I think very little has changed.
Yeah, and then also you've got things that are completely unregulated, like Parler, which is the latest social network for folks who feel that there's too much censorship happening on Facebook and Twitter, which that place is a trash fire. My goodness. I don't like to use that word, that phrase, too much, but my goodness, that place, I don't know how that social network is going to survive. I don't think it will, but there's a lot of problems there. Just a few more things I just want to mention before we get onto something a little bit lighter that happened this year. TikTok, there was the threat of TikTok being banned in the US. That's now been put on the back burner. Nothing is happening there. Absolutely nothing. There's nothing happening. There was big move about it. TikTok is dangerous. TikTok is siphoning data to China. TikTok is still working in the US. India has been banning.
Almost as if when Trump lost the election, he didn't care about the issue anymore.
Yeah, I know. I get the same feeling. I get the exact same feeling. India has been banning apps from China en masse throughout the year. WeChat was one, TikTok was another, and TikTok was actually banned in India before it was banned in the US. So who copied who there, Trump? And then I think one of the ones that I did definitely miss was Epic's battle with Apple, which is still ongoing, but the Epic title Fortnite, I don't know, have you guys heard of this game?
Indie title, yeah.
Yeah.
My young nephew plays it. A few of his friends.
Okay. Maybe we should check it out. Anyway, that game is not available on iOS or any Apple device, to be quite clear, as of right now. And we don't think that it will be until at least July next year when a court case takes place. So, yeah, lots and lots of stuff happened this year, even though we were all stuck inside. It's been a very depressing year now that we look back on it. Yeah, here's to 2021 being better.
because we all know that a change of calendars means everything to the world.
Yeah, the humans love to assign special meanings to round numbers and changes and things like that. We like to think things will change because of external happenstance, but that's usually not the case.
Yeah. So,
well, I mean, things can change. It doesn't mean it's going to be better. I think we all thought that 2019 was as bad as it could get. Now, don't worry about it. I got you guys. Don't worry.
In the middle of the year, there were all those screenshots from social media saying 2019 was my worst year. I can't wait for 2020. 2020 is going to be the summer of George, stuff like that. And we all know how that went. But I think we're gonna shift gears. We've been prattling on for a while. We're going to talk about some different stuff now.
Yeah. So as we were all stuck indoors, I think it's a good thing to reflect on some of the games that we played this year, especially with Cyberpunk being...
Oh, Cyberpunk.
Let's not talk about Cyberpunk, though. Let's talk about some good games that we played this year. Damn, I didn't. That was a Freudian slip. I didn't mean to say that Cyberpunk...
Jade.
Or are the games that don't crash?
Yeah, games.
It seems like a good game that just seems to crash all the time.
Clinton, I think you start us off. Let's go through some of your favorite games that you played in 2020.
I'm going to go through them pretty quick. Again, we're going on for a while here. I want to talk about some games I played quick. So I want to talk about two games I played at launch that were not great at launch, like Cyberpunk. They were Marvel's Avengers and Horizon Zero Dawn. Horizon Zero Dawn has thankfully been patched and is pretty stable right now. And that game was delivered as a complete edition with expansions and DLC and has since gone on to be very stable, and I'd recommend people buy it. Avengers, on the other hand, might be a bit stable, but I wouldn't recommend anyone play that game because there's so little content. And all that the developers have seemed to do since it was released is they've released a new playable character, which was Kate. Kate Bishop, I think her name is. I'm not too familiar with her. But that introducing a new character does nothing for the game because the characters weren't the problem. It was what you can do with the characters. Yeah. That game has so little content. It's actually hilarious. They tried to build it as an online title that people would be playing for years at a time, but you could realistically finish the content in a week. So that game was a real train smash. Released this year through Early Access. It was in Early Access for, I think, 2 years, is Hades. Hades is maybe one of the best games I've ever played. No, it is one of the best games I've ever played and is maybe the best game of this year.
I would actually challenge you and say that it is the best game of the year.
Yeah, it's I'm just blown away by how good that game is. It runs really well, which is... Those three games we've discussed, Avengers, Horizon Zero Dawn, and Cyberpunk, when they launch, are just train wrecks in terms of performance. They don't run properly at all. And Hades, I played Hades when it was still in Early Access, and it was still fantastic. In terms of performance, it has some of the best art I've ever seen. Hades has probably the best voice acting in video games that I've ever experienced. A lot of people have said that the voice acting in Cyberpunk is pretty good, and that is a triple A... millions of dollars, maybe even 100 million or more. And the voice acting in Hades, which is made by a team of like 12 people in San Diego, I think in San Diego, where Supergiant Games is just the best I've ever heard. And it's hilarious because on the team and the external voice actors, they have people voicing like 3 or 4 characters and all of them sound fantastic and distinct. It's amazing. I cannot recommend Hades enough. I know it's a roguelike, which a lot of people don't like. They don't like playing games again and again. But yeah, Hades, best game of this year and one of the best games I've ever played. And I think we'll discuss this next year in 2021. But I really feel like there's a lot of negativity in the gaming world. You know, everyone gets canceled. Everyone gets exposed. Yeah. Everybody gets everybody. But, and, you know, games are going to be $70. Games in South Africa are approaching like 1,500 Rand each. There's microtransactions. There's so much bad stuff going on in the industry. But I really think we're in the golden age of gaming. I think every month a new game comes out that is one of the best games ever made. It's crazy. Even for people who only play like Call of Duty every year, or they only play FIFA, even for them, things are as good as they've ever been. Now, that's debatable because both of those games recycle content. And again, they're going up $10 and they got microtransactions. But I'm just surprised where every year we get to the end of the year and I think, wow, I played one of the games, which was one of the best experiences of my life. And then next year that happens again. So yeah, I really think we're in a golden age. The other games I played were the Pokemon DLC. That was fine. It should have been part of the base game. I am still playing the Pokemon trading card game, both in real life. I was until COVID, but I'm also still playing the online card game. That's still fun, even though the client looks like it's from the year 2000, because that's actually around the time it was released. So those are all the big games that I've played so far. There were some smaller ones that I, like Slash's Keep, I played the other day. But I think those were the big experiences of the year. I also played like Squadrons, but again, that was kind of a one and done deal. So those were the big games I played this year. It was good. I'm tired of playing games which shouldn't have been launched. And the Pokemon DLC was nothing. It should have been part of the main game. But yeah, Hades was the real standout of this year. And even though Brendan called Cyberpunk not a good game, I'm actually having fun with it. Again, we'll have a review out. I'm actually approaching 40 hours in the game. We got the game on release, so we didn't have a review ready for launch day. But I'll have a review very soon, probably Monday. And I'll lay everything out. It's going to be a very difficult game to review because it's absolutely broken in every aspect. It was rushed out. It was just removed from the PlayStation Store because of how broken it is and the fact that people have been refunding it. But I'm still having such a great time with it. So it's going to be an interesting review.
Yeah.
Check that out. So yeah, those are my games of the year, or at least those are the games that I played, but not paying attention to some of the smaller ones. Brendan, do you want to tell us?
Well, let's go with Robin first, because Robin is our de facto, what's the word? PlayStation reviewer. What did you play this year that you enjoyed, Robin?
So I don't want to really talk about what I enjoyed. I'd rather talk about what made an impression on me.
Oh, okay.
Some of them good, some of them not so good. But I think the fact that it left an impression counts for something.
Yeah.
The first has to be The Last of Us Part 2.
Mm-hmm.
It was obviously very divisive amongst the gaming community when it was released, especially given some of the decisions made by the developer Naughty Dog as far as the narrative and the fate of certain characters. I think it's not a spoiler anymore to say that Joel is no longer part of the game.
Yeah, no, it's not a spoiler.
All right, cool. Yeah, I think kind of pushing those elements aside as far as the decisions that were made, the game from a narrative perspective and visually was amazing. I think that's really worthwhile mentioning. I think it's also worthwhile talking about the fact that it was so divisive and it probably came at a time, this is kind of in the midst of COVID, where people were really on edge. And to have a game like it that was so hotly anticipated prove so divisive, I thought it was really interesting to see play out, whether or not you like the game or not. It was just kind of interesting from, a journalism perspective. And then that was quickly followed up by Ghost of Tsushima, which was a game that I was really looking forward to playing. And the fact that I played Last of Us Part 2 and then Ghost of Tsushima, the latter was a real great palette cleanser just because of how intense The Last of Us Part 2 was.
Mm-hmm. It's actually funny you say that. It shows such a difference because in Ghost of Tsushima, it's not like you're dealing with puppies and kitties. It's still a kind of a hectic story about your clan being killed and then you need to go on a massive revenge killing spree. But compare that to The Last of Us 2 and it's like an enliftment in spirit.
Yeah, it's like I'm busy decapitating Mongol warriors, but I'm having fun doing it. I really enjoyed it. I thought that it wasn't like officially like the last PS4 title, but I thought it was a great way to kind of sign off for the previous gen version as we kind of awaited for the next gen. And then speaking of the next gen, we've been lucky enough to play some of the release titles for the PS5. Miles Morales, I thought was a nice And people that are going to hate me for saying this, but in my mind, it's a DLC. It's not a standalone. The size of the game is DLC-esque in my view. But I really enjoyed that. I don't know if I would pay 1,200 rand for it, but that's perhaps a different discussion.
I just want to mention that before you go on, because I think at some point in South Africa for 1,300, you could get the version that had the Marvel Spider-Man, the enhanced edition, and Miles Morales, which I think was really worth the money.
Yeah, I think that's the one you should definitely reach for if you've got a PS5 at the moment.
100 rand for Marvel Spider-Man is crazy.
Yeah, actually, we just recently played and it was amazing. Then another game, I guess a PS5 game that I need to mention was Demon's Souls. It is brutal, it looks amazing, and for anyone that hasn't played kind of Souls-like kind of games before, it is very testing. You will die a lot, you will get frustrated a lot, but the mechanics and the visuals are stellar, and it's, in my review, I kind of said it was more than a remake. It wasn't just about the visuals, they kind of did a whole top-to-bottom kind of quality of life improvements across the board for the game. So yeah, I really enjoyed that, and I guess those are kind of the four-ish titles that kind of stood out for me this year.
Right, I suppose it's me now, hey?
Seems here.
Okay, so this year, obviously I played Hades. Quite enjoyed that. It was a very, very fun experience, even though I don't really like roguelike games. I really, really enjoyed this one. I also played Horizon Zero Dawn, which I played it on PlayStation, and playing it on PC was nice. But I don't know. For me, it was a great experience on PlayStation. It wasn't something that I felt that I needed to play again. But it's nice to have it on PC where you can crank the settings up to 111 and have a good time. I think the game that has left a bigger impression on me than I thought it would is a game that recently came out that I'm still busy playing, and I will have a review up soon, is for Immortals Phoenix Rising, which is a title from Ubisoft that is, it was kind of seen as Assassin's Creed Light. It's not like that at all. It's a platformer based in Greek mythology. And you play a character, Phoenix, who is trying to win back favor with the gods and save people. But it's a really engaging story, and it's just a fun game with a few RPG mechanics, a few hack and slash mechanics, which are both genres that I really enjoy. It's turning out to be quite an interesting title. Obviously, though, the bulk of my year has gone to Destiny 2, which has been hit and miss throughout the year. Bungie is now completely severed from Activision, or Blizzard Activision, rather. And that is starting to show, starting to see that maybe Bungie isn't as well-equipped to deal with publishing a title like Destiny 2 on its own. There's a couple of weird decisions that have been made recently as regards sunsetting of gear and weapons, which basically means that anything that you have that is a year or older is basically useless in the game because it can't be made to a higher power level, which is something that you can do in Destiny. You can kind of take gear with you to a certain point and infuse it with materials to get up to a higher power level, but now you can't do that for gear that's a year older. And this is problematic because there are expansions that are 2 years old, which you can buy right now, but all the gear that you get from them is useless to you, which is a bit of a sore spot for me and a couple of other people in the community. They also released their latest expansion, Beyond Light, which was delayed by about 3 months. It was meant to come out in September. It eventually came out in November. And yeah, it's just been a really weird year for Destiny. There's been some big wins and some very big losses as well. But I think the thing that stands out to me the most is a puzzle that happened at the beginning of the year for Destiny, which required basically the entire community to participate in order to solve the puzzle,
which was, for me, the moment where Destiny is great, where you're playing with friends and you are engaging with the world and engaging with the community. And that was really, really nice to see. Obviously, I'm playing Cyberpunk at the moment. I'm enjoying it, but yeah, it's definitely buggy, and there are some really hardcore problems that need to be fixed that a couple of patches aren't going to fix.
I just want to say I am playing on PC, but I have everything set to low.
Yeah.
Even on medium, the game chugs. And I don't have like a space computer over here. Yeah. I'll put this in my review. I don't want to harp too much on Cyberpunk, but man, it's bugged. Man, it's not ready for release. I think in a year, it might be one of the best games ever made. But in the end of 2020, it's one of the worst made in terms of technical stuff. Again, the full review will be out soon.
And then something that I don't think anybody was expecting me to mention is Hearthstone.
Oh yeah, my God.
So many years ago, I used to play Hearthstone very regularly. And in the past couple of months, I have taken back to that. However, I'm not playing or paying for cards and that sort of thing anymore, which is seemingly a good move because people are very upset with Blizzard about how much they're charging folks to play Hearthstone. But there is a free mode called Battlegrounds, which is an auto-battler. I'm sure if you've played auto-chess or something similar to that, you will know what this is. But yeah, that's quite fun, and it's 100% free, and yeah, Blizzard doesn't get any of my money, so that's really great. But that's basically what I've been playing for the most part throughout the year. Destiny, bit of the new releases that have come out. Obviously, there's also Assassin's Creed Valhalla, which is a really, really great title. If you are not an Assassin's Creed fan, I understand. But this game is very, very special. There's a really great story being told here. There's the most sort of freedom I felt in an Assassin's Creed game since, I can't even remember, possibly Black Flag. And it's actually, for me, it's a better game than Black Flag. So if you're looking for a new game to play, Assassin's Creed Valhalla is really, really good. And if you like Vikings, it's definitely, definitely worth your time. But yeah, I mean, like Clinton, I think that there's been, looking back at the year, there's been some really, really stellar releases. I know everybody was very hyped for Cyberpunk, but I mean, we've seen now that maybe that hype was a bit misplaced. Even though
it's on brand for 2020, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
corpo screwed us over.
The corpo screwed us over. But yeah, I think that this is it's been a good year for games in general. I mean, we had Animal Crossing and Doom Eternal right at the top of the year.
Didn't even mention those. Maybe it's because it was a while ago and we don't remember, but it's also because, like I said, so many good games come out every month that you can just kind of get swamped.
Yeah, and it's really hard to pick one that you remember.
I'm surprised you didn't shout out Godfall.
Oh, yeah, Godfall, that great game that I got for free and still haven't played. Just as a note, it was not a review title. It was not a review code that I got. It was a free code that I got for purchasing a GPU. further to that, I also got a code for World of Warcraft Shadowlands. I haven't played that because I don't really want to give Blizzard any more time than I'm giving them already. But yeah, it's been a good year for games. Not a good year for everything else, but thankfully we've all been stuck at home and we can enjoy those games. So yeah, I think that's going to wrap it up from us for this year. Not even just today, for this year. It's been a tough one, folks. The next couple of weeks, everybody's going to hopefully be able to see their families. If you are seeing your families and you are seeing older folks, please just be safe before you go and visit them and after you've seen them. Wear a mask. This is not a debate thing. Like, please wear a mask. These days, if you aren't wearing a mask in public and a cop sees you, that's a fine or 6 months in jail. So stay safe out there. We would love to welcome you back next year. President Cyril Ramaphosa's latest address was very sobering, especially with comments about that this could be the last Christmas for a lot of people. So yeah, we're only as strong as our weakest member of society. I think that is something very important to note. And yeah, just stay safe, folks, please. This is not a time for conspiracy theories and trying to think that you're cleverer than anybody else. Listen to the experts, listen to authoritative and like proper news organizations. OAN is not a proper news organization. But yeah, stay safe out there, folks, and thank you so much for everything this year. But I think from myself, Brendan Losh, cheerio, from Clinton Matos.
Bye, everybody.
And from Robin Michetti.
Take care, everyone.
We'll see you next year. Cheerio.
Bye.
Sorry, the number you have dialed is not in service at this time.